Hello and welcome to Systems of Harm, a podcast brought to you by Frankly Design. I'm your host, Amy Hupe, and each week I'll be speaking to a new guest about their experience of working with design systems and their personal experiences of marginalisation. My guest today is Fred Warburton. I met Fred back in 2020 when we worked together on the design system for Babylon Health. And not long before I met Fred, he had received a life-changing diagnosis of retinitis pigmentosa, which is a hereditary and degenerative eye condition. Following his diagnosis, Fred developed an intense curiosity about the accessibility of digital products. And in the time we worked together, I was absolutely blown away by his skill, grace, and pragmatism of his ability to advocate for the importance of accessibility and effect meaningful and lasting change. I'm so excited to introduce you to Fred. Let's get going. Fred, welcome to Systems of Harm. You are not going to be the first published episode, but you are the first episode that I'm recording. So no pressure. Don't mess it up, okay?
How exciting. I'm the guinea pig.
You are the guinea pig. This could all go horribly
wrong.
Thank
you very much for having me on. I feel privileged to be here.
You are very privileged to be here. So we're going to talk today about accessibility and design systems, and we have lots of things to cover. But the very first thing that I want to do is get you to tell me a bit about how you came to work in this area of accessibility. Take us back in time.
Okay. I'll take you back. So I suppose I should start sort of, I studied product design. So I'm coming at sort of accessibility, not necessarily from the sort of technical engineering background, but more from the inclusive design, product design sort of background, I guess. My sort of real journey in terms of accessibility started out at a company called Babylon Health, a health tech company. At that stage, they were primarily based in the UK, but then sort of had offices all over the world, really. And I started there as a sort of associate studio manager fairly early on in my career. Previously, I'd worked at a sort of couple of agencies in London, and also sort of worked in the fashion industry for a short time. But I sort of moved to Babylon Health as I said, as an associate studio manager, working with the experienced design team, focusing really on design operations at that point. So fast forward 3 or 4 months into my sort of journey at Babylon, I had sort of been noticing that I'd been struggling in low light conditions or flat light conditions, places sort of like airports and my favorite places of all, pubs. I'd noticed that I was struggling a little bit with my vision, and I ended up sort of walking into bar stools and people. It wasn't
all down to
the beer consumption. Not all down to the beer consumption. It sort of transpired. So I went to see an optician, and they ran a few tests and then lots of mumbling to their sort of people in the opticians amongst themselves. And then at the end of this sort of optician's appointment, they said, I think you should go to an eye hospital. And they referred me really to go to Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, which many of the listeners may be familiar with. And I got an appointment with an ophthalmologist and ran a load more tests. This is a recurring theme. And it basically sort of transpired that I had a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which is a degenerative retinal disorder. That there's no sort of known or cure for. So I was told there and then that I was losing my vision, and there was a sort of a high possibility that I'd ultimately lose all of my vision, but I couldn't put a time frame on it. And this sort of really made me, quite selfishly, I guess, reevaluate how I approach sort of my design work and my work at Babylon. And sort of following a few days, I still, I guess, coming to terms with this information and this sort of circumstance that had been thrust upon me, I guess. And I went back to work and sort of started having a look around and understanding, trying to get an understanding of how accessible that particular product was at the time. So looking under the hood and testing the mobile app with it, the screen reader, and doing some basic sort of accessibility checks, but I knew absolutely nothing in this field, really, if I'm honest, past sort of basic visual design skills, I guess, you could say. So it transpired that it was a big mess. There was absolutely, to use the car analogy, there was basically no engine under the hood, and it was a complete oversight, it seemed. And so I took sort of this information and went to the then head of design and head of engineering and said, look, this is a problem, it seems. I'd like to investigate this in more detail. And that really is sort of where my journey with accessibility began. Fast forward 4 or 5 years, it's been my main focus really since then, and I've been sort of empowered to investigate so where things were at Babylon and works sort of as my day-to-day role focusing on accessibility and inclusive design.
So I think one question I have sort of off the bat, and we've obviously spoken about this a little bit in the past, but what was it like going and making that request? Like, what was the response like when you said, you know, I think you need to invest, you need to allow me to invest some time in this and eventually invest some money into it?
So at that stage, I didn't really know what I was asking for, if I'm honest. I didn't really know how to approach this. I just knew that it was something that I wanted to do. And so I didn't really know what I was signing myself up for at that point, if I'm honest. However, sort of when I did go and see the sort of head of design at that point, I don't think this was new information for them necessarily. So I think that there was an understanding that this is not something that had been given a time of day, essentially, before. And there was, to an extent, a willingness to address this sort of gap. And I was really well supported in that sort of initial endeavor. And at the time, I was sort of, I put the cards on the table and said, I don't know a great deal about this area. It's not something that I've done in the past, but I would like support and sort of the opportunity to take this forward and really drive it. But what I didn't have in sort of technical knowledge, I had a great deal of sort of willingness and passion, I guess, that had been developed more or less pretty quickly in this area, due to sort of personal circumstances. But I knew I couldn't do this on my own, and I needed to get support from experts in the industry. I was very quickly and very luckily and fortunately directed to Leonie Watson.
Who
is a fantastic accessibility sort of professional and wonderful, sort of at that point, really great sort of mentor and someone I could sort of talk to and understand how to sort of unpack this huge, I guess, kind of worms that had opened up at Babylon. And it just sort of fortunately transpired that Leonie had set up her own sort of agency called Tetralogical. I think we were one of the early clients for the company at that point. And initially, we sort of had a few chats and I sort of decided that we would set a sort of benchmark, understand where we're at, try and get a handle on sort of where the biggest gaps were. And so we sort of conducted a a bit of auditing on some of the sort of highly used products, I guess, our main product lines. And that uncovered exactly sort of what I suspected of huge amounts of gaps and really not a great situation at that point.
And why do you think that was? Do you think it was a lack of awareness or a lack of willingness to make things accessible? What do you think was the main sort of main cause there?
I don't think there's like a conscious decision to exclude people. And I generally, as I've sort of worked with various companies, I don't think I've ever come across engineers or designers or product managers that are going out of their way to deliberately exclude people. I think there is a lack of awareness and understanding. And I think that stems from like very early on in terms of my journey, sort of studying product design. Inclusive design and themes around inclusive design were touched upon, but it's not front and center in people's education, I don't think. And so there's a huge gap there. And I think there is work being done to address that. But until it becomes front and center in design technology in schools and interwoven through sort of university degrees, and it's that sort of, it's got that primary seat at the table, I think it's going to be a problem unless companies are prioritizing this and it's got significant backing from sort of C-suite people, so chief executives and others. And until there's an acceptance that this is an absolute necessity to provide equal opportunities and equal experiences for everyone out there, it's you're going to have huge gaps in knowledge and that become more difficult, I think, to fill over time as well, as you get a company off the ground, and if you don't factor things in early, it becomes much more difficult to retrofit this and drive this sort of cultural change. So I think that to answer the question, it's a huge sort of mishmash of issues. I think it's that sort of lack of awareness, but also the cultural and institutional issues in education. I think there's a huge gap there. I think also there's issues in the tech sector in particular around like inclusion and a sort of workforce not necessarily being representative of the people that you're serving and your products are serving. And so if you don't have a representative workforce of folk with disabilities and you're not working alongside people with disabilities, then inevitably, you know, these things aren't surfaced and often things get missed.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's interesting for me to kind of reflect on and think about, like, how would it have played out at Babylon if it wasn't you leading the charge there? Because obviously you had that very kind of personal connection to the issue that you were talking about and the problems that you were kind of flagging. So, you know, to take a kind of cynical view of it, it's much harder to sit opposite somebody who you know is going to rely on these changes at some point and say, no, we're not going to invest in that. You know, do you think that kind of influenced them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very, as I said, there was not a willingness or a desire to exclude anyone at Babylon, and I'm firm in that position. But there was equally that sort of lack of awareness, and I think my situation and has sort of made it quite tangible for people, and it is far more difficult, I think, to relate to some of this stuff if you know you don't have an inclusive sort of workforce or representative workforce, because you know it's just it's far more theoretical and not in front of your face, as you said. So I think there's a huge opportunity for companies to ensure that their hiring practices and their sort of recruitment strategies are inclusive and enabling better product development fundamentally by including sort of diverse workforce, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And it when, you know, we talked a little bit about kind of barriers to doing this work, and something that I've definitely encountered, and I think you probably have too, is we're saying we worked together at Babylon. That's how we met, right? So we, how long ago was that now? Like 3 years ago? Beginning, just before the pandemic, wasn't it?
A little bit more, maybe. Yeah.
And then we became best friends forevermore.
Well.
Wow.
Speak for yourself, Eric.
Entirely my mind. But so we were talking a little bit about kind of barriers and stuff, and something that I think I saw at Babylon, and I think I've probably seen everywhere that I've worked, except perhaps government, where I think the culture of accessible design is very strong, is this kind of sense that it's got to be kind of all or nothing. Like you have to do, you know, there's this very perfectionist mindset around accessibility, which I think sometimes can intimidate people out of wanting to tackle it at all, because it's like, we know our products are inaccessible. We know we can't fix everything overnight. This is a huge piece of work. So like, is there any point in doing some work to improve the accessibility of your products? And is doing that going to just draw the attention to the problem, all the problems that you have and that you don't yet have the capacity or the time to solve? So like, what's your view on that? Do you know, do you see that? And do you think that it is valuable to make kind of incremental improvements and to do something rather than, you know, rather than thinking of it as all or nothing? Can it be all or something?
Absolutely. Like, it's sort of my personal experience is absolutely littered with this sort of mindset of you know, I think if we weren't fixing all these issues, then the work's not valuable. And in hindsight, I think it sort of stems from a sort of slight audit mentality. Mm-hmm. So lots of companies go off and get audits in relation to sort of various, I guess, compliance requirements. Dirty word.
Why is it dirty word? Say more about that.
I don't think it's a dirty word, really, but it depends how you go about it, and if you use it as a sort of measure of success, that it can be problematic, I think, in terms of various standards out there. But obviously in the accessibility world, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, catchily named, the sort of various versions of those are often used as targets.
Yeah.
Rather than what they actually are, which is a very baseline requirement for sort of creating equitable experiences, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think there's sort of when that is the case, there becomes this sort of box checking mentality, and it's very possible, you know, like any set of guidelines cannot guarantee that products are accessible, but more importantly, usable and a good experience for folk. So I think they need to be, they're useful tools, and they for sure are, have their place and are important. And the working group at the W3C have done an exceptional job of putting them together. But they are just a part of the picture. They're not the sort of be all and end all, I guess.
Yeah, and I suppose if you're coming at it purely from a kind of compliance perspective, then perhaps, you know, you're likely to, things are going to fall out of date, right? Because even from, if you make things tick those boxes, the standards are going to change, things are going to change. You really need to go into it with a mentality of wanting to make things more inclusive and more accessible, for, because that in itself is an important goal and is an important endeavor, not just because you want to make sure that you're being legally compliant. I mean, for me personally,
absolutely.
A phrase that I would love to see just get in the fucking sea is does it pass accessibility? Like, you know, when people say that, and it's like, what do you mean?
It passes accessibility. Yeah, it's all too often thrown around that. Or this product is fully accessible.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, what do you mean by that?
Exactly.
Tell me more, please.
Yeah.
The first person in history to achieve that, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting sort of dynamic in terms of, I think there's not, it's an all too common feeling to think that, you know, once you're ticking certain boxes, the job is done, and we know that's absolutely not the case as well. You know, like, things change, code changes over time, design thinking changes over time, best practices change over time, and I think that we need to be approaching accessibility sort of from a much in the same way that we approach sort of more traditional user experience design. Like, there's no difference to sort of, I think, creating good experiences for people. People are sort of fundamentally the same in terms of, you know, wanting easy and sort of barrier-free experiences, regardless of whether you're disabled or not. And I think that if we can sort of flip the conversation away sort of from compliance and more into towards sort of testing and running research with, you know, representative audiences, or those using your products that include, you say, traditionally marginalized groups and people that have been traditionally excluded from using digital products, then I think, yeah, all the better for it, for sure.
Definitely. So we have got probably halfway into this podcast now, and we haven't even talked about design systems yet, which is what I want to kind of touch on next. So you, as well as being kind of, what was your role title at the point that you left Babylon? Were you lead accessibility and design systems lead?
I was a design manager working across the sort of central accessibility team, but also our design system team.
Yeah, so you were leading the design system work, taking over from me, and I think we can agree I did a fantastic job there.
Fantastic foundations in place.
Fantastic, yeah, foundations, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely seamless. But so one thing that, you know, I kind of want to ask you is, if you are somebody who's working on a design system team and you are interested in how your team can contribute to making your products, your company's products, more accessible, but you just don't really know where to start, what would your advice be? Like, I mean, I guess one of the things that occurs to me is the first step is to start building advocacy. And it's not very often that I pay you a genuine compliment, but I'm gonna, so prepare yourself. Like, one of the things that most impressed me about you, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you on this, is because you did probably some of the most impressive work that I've ever seen in building support and building advocacy within Babylon for accessibility, not just with kind of senior stakeholders, but also amongst designers and developers, and really kind of getting people to understand why it mattered and to sort of champion accessibility from wherever they sat in the organization. So do you have any kind of thoughts about how people can approach that? If the very first step is like, how can I get people around me interested in this?
Yeah, I think it's about sort of uncovering sort of where the people you maybe are sort of trying to convince what's causing them problems, or what things are they trying to solve for the particular business. So when this isn't really related to design systems, we've gone more into
gone back again.
I guess it is.
It's all related.
I guess
it's
it
all connected.
But I think understanding your audience when sort of trying to build a business case for accessibility is important. So what the sort of the patter and and sales sort of pitch, I guess, if you want to call it that, for accessibility when talking to someone in a legal team will be very, very different from sales pitch and patter for someone in sort of the design team, I guess. And so understanding where people are at and what their goals are in relation to the business is important. And then sort of tailoring your arguments around that, I found is important. So for example, I think it's really key that we don't necessarily sort of separate accessibility off from design, and I think accessibility is an inclusive design. It's a fundamental part of a designer's job and role in it, and ultimately it's everyone's duty to be sort of creating the best product possible. And so I think it where I would start is definitely sort of around the education piece and advocacy piece, but know that, you know, you're not going to know it all. Like you can't just sort of absorb all of this knowledge immediately, and accepting that, but then trying to sort of point people to useful resources and not necessarily sort of trying to reinvent the wheel. There's lots of great resources and people out there that are doing a fantastic job at in sort of their particular area and pocket in terms of accessibility and inclusive design and design systems as well. And so sharing a resource here or there, or sharing a video, whatever, a rambling podcast like this, maybe it might be useful. Well, on my part, you're doing a great job, Amy. But I think just starting the conversation, you know, that's the first step, and sort of creating a space for this conversation. That's I think is a great first step, and going beyond that, trying to sort of educate and provide opportunities for education is key. So I mentioned that one of the first things we did is create sort of at Babylon is to sort of do this auditing journey, I guess. We followed that quickly up with a huge sort of rounds of training. So you can't just expect people to understand and know what they're doing in terms of accessibility. But it was key for me to provide people with an opportunity to develop their skills. And so bringing in external trainers and really making the sessions focused to sort of where folk are at. So sort of within any organization, you're going to have different levels of knowledge of every topic, I guess. But in terms of accessibility, we certainly sort of had that at Babylon. And so bringing external trainers in and splitting out into smaller groups related, and the training topics were related to particular disciplines. So we did a sort of more advanced sessions for front-end engineers that had some level of familiarity with the subject matter, and then sort of more basic foundational training for other engineers that maybe hadn't been exposed to sort of working with accessibility as much. And the same with design, research, content, and product managers as well, and just tailoring those sort of sessions to people's needs, but doing that sort of groundwork to understand really where people's levels of knowledge is at is important, because you're never going to walk away from a 1-3 hour workshop with all the knowledge that, you know, and leaving the session, going into the session with no knowledge and leaving it with sort of being an expert in this area. It's just not going to happen. Like, it doesn't work like that. But I think you can definitely get more out of the session if you're sort of like benchmarking people's levels of knowledge and then hitting them sort of with the right level of training at the right sort of altitude, I guess. I think that's really important, because you can lose people very easily in sort of theoretical based training and even practical training if they feel, you know, that it's too basic for them or too advanced for them. And either way, like, it's very easy to sort of lose people at that point. So I think if I would start with sort of advocacy, but then going into sort of education, sort of trying to build up and sort of set a baseline foundational knowledge within the company, if nothing else, people have gone through sort of training, and have heard the term accessibility, have understood sort of the basics, then, you know, that conversation keeps rolling on, and you have something to build from, the sort of foundation to start this work from. So that was a sort of important step. And in retrospect, I would have not approached the work sort of from an auditing point of view. I would have started with sort of that education and advocacy piece. Yeah, I think that's sort of where I start in terms of one thing that I sort of early doors recognizes that I didn't have that level of knowledge to be able to support teams across the company, and that's where I very heavily relied on sort of friends at Tetralogical to provide various levels of service. But one thing that was a real winner, I think, for us as an organization was, I say us, I no longer work at Babylon, but Babylon as an organization, was having a sort of support and help desk outlet for people to go to. And that was primarily used at that point sort of by the technical teams, but it served a sort of broader purpose as well. For operations team support folk who had queries or questions. It was just an area that people could go to in a safe space with people to ask questions, and having that outlet at that location, that sort of community area that people can go to, that's a major step forward and a great starting point as well. So there's a few things that you can do. Ideally, sort of staffing that help desk with a variety of expertise is also like really key. So you want people that have sort of technical understanding of accessibility, but also experts in design, research, content. That's a luxury if you can do that. I'd highly recommend, I guess many agencies out there that provide those services, but yeah, was very, very fortunate to work with Tetralogical on that.
Yeah, they were great. I remember them being sort of very supportive and non-judgmental, which I think is really important, because I think you have to
create an
environment where it's okay for people to ask questions and, like you say, to not
absolutely
have the answers. Because it can be
intimidating,
I think, when people start
completely. Completely, yeah. It's really important to have that sort of accessibility is fundamentally about the culture of an organization as well. I believe like it's like sort of creating inclusive and accessible products is only possible if you have great sort of a good culture and good organizational buy-in and understanding of why this is important. And anything you can do to support and sort of develop that inclusive culture is really, really important.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think it's really interesting what you said about, if in hindsight you wouldn't start with auditing, but you'd actually start with that kind of almost like benchmarking the knowledge level across the organization.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's true, isn't it? It's like if you want to be able to sustain the improvements that you're making over time, you know, those, if people don't understand how to build accessible products and how to design accessible products, then all of those problems that you're going to fix at this point in time are just going to come back in. Because people won't know how to.
You see them again 3 months down the line.
Yeah. Which is
absolutely
annoying.
Absolutely. Very annoying. But and I think it depends on the auditing services that you're using and the nature of the audit. But often you'll see products or audits come back. They'll outline the issues. They'll outline a way to fix something. And then the initial reaction of teams will be, right, let's get everything fixed. Let's go and sort it all out, whatever. And you may go and you may go and fix these individual issues, but you're not addressing the underlying issue, which is sort of why and how they came about in the first place, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of like if you had a leak in your bathroom, it's like the equivalent of just like mopping the floor but not fixing the leak, isn't it?
Yeah, so you want to absolutely
kind of fix it at the source. Yeah, definitely. So we've talked a little bit about kind of not reinventing the wheel and leaning on experts, because there are lots of experts out there. There are lots of resources that people can turn to if they want to start understanding more about accessibility. And not reinventing the wheel is obviously an important pillar of design systems work. So one thing that I wanted to ask you is, what do you think the opportunities are for design systems to support the creation and this kind of maintenance, I suppose, of accessible products? And what is the limit to that? You know, what can they not do, I think?
So I think design systems can be an extremely sort of useful pillar and tool to make people's lives easier and to make creating sort of inclusive and accessible products slightly less daunting, particularly for sort of front-end engineers and designers. And I think, but equally, I think design systems can cause huge issues if attention isn't paid to sort of accessibility and inclusive design at the right time. And so the nature of a design system is that you're sort of, we're obviously, you know, a source of truth, but also like a place for reusable front-end code. And if that front-end code is perpetuating issues, it quickly sort of exacerbates small issues that you have in an individual component, can very quickly become sort of system-wide issues plastered across all products in an organization. And I think there needs to be a sort of particular understanding that creating a component for a design system is a different process than creating a sort of single-use component. You need to be really paying sort of attention to the sort of design fundamentals, but also investing in research and investing in testing, you know, with people with disabilities and ensuring that the design process and engineering process and the rigor that creating sort of that reusable component entails is including things like inclusive design reviews and automated testing, but also manual accessibility testing and sort of code reviews with a focus on accessibility throughout that process, so that then you can go with confidence and add components or patterns to a system that you have confidence in are sort of built on solid foundations and accessible. I think problems start arising when you don't necessarily have those processes in place or maybe documented, and there's slightly design systems are sort of seen more as a warehouse for reusable code, and there's not that sort of process or structure to sort of setting a quality bar, I guess, within the design systems, because then, you know, bad patterns can sort of be propagated across, you know, widely across, you know, products in an organization. That's where we see sort of big sort of systemic issues. So I think it can go both ways. I think if you have the right sort of processes and checks in place to ensure that you're building quality, that can be a hugely useful tool for sort of delivering accessibility at scale, with it, obviously with the limitations that we can discuss. But if not approached in a logical or appropriate way, I think it can be a real, I guess, to coin a phrase, you know, system of harm. I think it can be really damaging for an organization. So spending time and putting attention on the fundamentals early in the process is absolutely key. And having that understanding that you know, what goes into creating a great reusable component or design pattern in a design system is not the same as creating a sort of single use item that can live within a product.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a kind of level of versatility, isn't there, that's needed for design system solutions that isn't necessarily required of individual product solutions. I think, yeah, I mean, the thing that kind of I find myself saying quite often is design systems are not neutral scaling machines. Like, they scale things, that's all they do. But, like,
yeah,
they're not inherently harmless. Like you said, it's kind of if what you're providing to people via the system is accessible, is high quality, is usable, is good, then, you know, the stuff that it's used in has a higher chance of being good, and those are the things that are going to get scaled and amplified within your organization's kind of product landscape. If it's not, then all you're doing is scaling crap, you know, and that's not,
yeah,
you know, that's not inherently valuable. So I think that that's a really important point. I guess on that note, something that I am also kind of interested to talk about is, what's the limitation to this? Because, you know, you often hear design system teams talking about how their components have accessibility built in. And that always frustrates me a little bit, because I think it can imply, I think, to product teams using the design system that they're going to just get something accessible out of the box as long as they use the system's components and patterns. And actually,
yeah,
there is still, I think, a responsibility for product teams to do their own testing to make sure that things are accessible in context. So how do you kind of see that relationship? Where do you see that line between a product team's responsibility and a design system team's responsibility?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, a design system and the sort of tools within it, within that, are one part of the puzzle, I guess. It's a set of, in theory, accessible components, whatever that really means, you know, in a design system is not going to guarantee an accessible product, far from it. I mean, that there are decisions that can sort of be made within and as part of the process of creating sort of tooling within a design system that can definitely support and provide almost a scaffolding for teams to help them get things right. But there is an onus on, I guess we could call sort of teams consuming design system components or patterns to ensure that they are working together in harmony. So ensuring that, you know, that elements or components can be accessed with assistive technology, and ensuring that so they work together in a logical and meaningful manner is hugely important. You're not going to do that by just individually testing sort of a footer component or a header component. Yes, you can understand whether that works in isolation, but it's not necessarily going to work with other components in a product. And so having that understanding of the limitations of what a design system can do, but also ensuring that as part of documentation and guidance within the design system, just making that explicit and clear that, you know, these steps still need to take place. This is, I think, being frank and clear about the accessibility of the pattern or component within a docs is useful, because if nothing else, it starts to, you know, encourage that conversation around accessibility. But ensuring that, you know, there is an expectation and understanding from users that it is just a sort of one part of the puzzle is super key. And I think that can be done, yes, through documentation, but also sort of systems and processes at the sort of, I guess, product team level. So understanding that for all new front end features or features that involve new front end code, I think it's absolutely critical that journeys and experiences are tested and with real users first and foremost, but also tested by by people in the way that they're sort of consuming that content. So you're not going to individually consume, as an end user, you're not going to individually be sort of worried about individual accessibility, individual comparison. You want a barrier-free end-to-end experience, right?
Yeah.
And so understanding and having an appreciation for how your design work is being consumed by end users is critical and key.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, we talked a lot about the things that design system teams give to product teams and, you know, where their kind of responsibility ends and where product teams' responsibilities start. I think just for the three listeners of this podcast, I am loving the fact that you've been plunged into darkness. You're dialing into this from a little booth in our office, and it's got a light on a timer, and you're just sitting there in like pitch black at this
point. I'm trying to wave. It's great.
It's not working.
Someone that can't see in the dark.
I can't see your, yeah. And I can't see your face anymore either, which is a treat for me. So everybody wins.
Brutal.
So we've talked about kind of the things that design system teams give to product teams to use. But I also think a really important role that they can play is in that sort of education that we talked about. And I remember something that we used to do at Babylon was we had Ian from Tetralogical used to join our kind of component review calls as a sort of accessibility representative. And I used to find having him there was such a valuable thing, because it wasn't just a case of getting his feedback and his sort of expert view to help us improve the component. It was also the fact that we had sort of 30 odd other designers and developers on the call who were hearing that feedback and who could hear his perspective. And were therefore sort of just by osmosis, just by kind of being there, we're getting this kind of ambient education in accessibility.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that there's definitely kind of opportunities for design systems to provide those kind of touch points and those opportunities for education in terms of the practices and the processes that sit around them.
Hugely agree. And I referenced education earlier and used the standard sort of approach of theoretical or practical sort of training, I guess. But it doesn't sort of just start and finish there. There are opportunities to educate, and anything you do in terms of accessibility, you must see it as an opportunity to educate. And the same, obviously, with design systems. But working in the open, doing design reviews in the open, giving people exposure and that ability to hear from folk that are sort of have expertise in these fields is key. And it sort of starts to encourage and enable those conversations to happen more freely across teams, even when sort of those experts may not be in the room. I think that's, and the same goes for sort of documentation. I think if you are weaving in sort of strands around accessibility into documentation and understanding maybe snippets from research or various other bits and pieces and weaving in how things are working with assistive technology, it just encourages that conversation and enables sort of it to be, I guess, normalized and just really encourages that sort of culture and cultural awareness in an organization that maybe has had been sort of lacking that for a period of time. So anything you can do to sort of, I guess, further the messaging around the benefits of this work is super key. And I think a design system has a huge part to play in that.
Definitely. Well, I think that's a lovely note to wrap up on. I think certainly agreed, design system teams have a role to play, an important role to play in kind of creating more accessible products and a culture of accessibility that you talked about. I think that's kind of the key thing that I've kind of taken away from this conversation is how important it is to have that culture of designing for disabled people and making sure that our products are accessible and how that can benefit everybody if we do that. Is there anything you would like to say before we wrap up?
I think, thank you very much for having me on. I think I've learned a tremendous amount from yourself and the great work you've done in design systems. And I think it's a sort of design systems and accessibility are sort of a match made in heaven in a way, and can really be opportunities, as we've discussed, to sort of drive good patterns at sort of scale and ensure that, I guess, accessibility has a seat at the table when it comes to design and engineering. So thank you for being a fantastic advocate and teaching me so much over the years.
Thank you, Fred. A match made in heaven indeed, just like you and me. That was Fred Warburton talking about design systems and accessibility. You can find links to Fred's Twitter and any links mentioned in today's episode in the show notes. Thank you to Chris Iansen and James Bevan at 199 for production support, and to Ollie Strang for the episode artwork. We'll be back next week with a new episode. And until then, thank you for listening to Systems of Harm, a podcast by Frankly Design. If you like what you heard, please leave us a review on your favourite podcast platform, and don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date with all of our latest episodes. If you've got any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me on Twitter at Amy_Hoop, or you can email me at hello@wearefrankly.co. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next time.